Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla, in for David Martin Davies. August 17th marked over 200 years since Davy Crockett was born. Crockett was a politician and soldier who died at the Alamo fighting for Texas's independence. Today we're listening to my interview with film director David Zucker. Along with his brother Jerry Zucker and their friend Jim Abrams, the trio directed and produced the 1980 movie Airplane, which has become a classic in cinema.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Zucker has also directed the Naked Gun series starring Leslie Nielsen and the latter Scary Movies in the early 2000s. When I interviewed Zucker in December of 2023, he was in San Antonio to unveil the last letter Davy Crockett wrote in Tennessee at the Alamo. This letter was written before Crockett came to Texas. Crockett is known as the King of the Wild Frontier and became a folk hero. But he was also much more than that, says David Zucker. Let's listen to my interview with David.
It's nice to be here, wherever this is.
And so, David, you're joining us in studio, but you didn't just come to our studio all the way over here to talk about movies. You're in San Antonio for a pretty special reason. So you're here to unveil Davy Crockett's final letter that he wrote in Tennessee before he made his journey to Texas. So you've been in possession of this letter. Can you tell us about the event that's going on?
Well, what I'm doing is donating this letter to the Alamo Museum, this new thing that they've done, which I've been hoping that they would do something like this for decades. And I think I wrote a letter to the editor of one of the newspapers saying, you know, they should have a really, you know, first-class, world-class museum here, blah, blah, blah. So they finally did, and I'll be back in 2027 to see it open. But for right now, I've given them this letter that I bought in Lubbock about 25 years ago.
And can you tell us more about what the letter says?
The letter says Davy Crockett is writing to his brother-in-law and says, tomorrow I leave for the Texas. They would use the article, and I think they spelled it T-E-X-E-S. And he says, and I plan to explore the Texas well before I return. And there's a lot of family gossip that he proceeds to write about in the letter.
So does the letter give you any insight as to what sort of character he was, or is there a line that sticks out to you? What sticks out to you?
Well, there's a little bit. I mean, there's a little bit, you know, a lot of his personality shows through in all his letters. And I have several other Crockett letters in my collection. And some of them are, he's railing against Andrew Jackson, you know, saying that Andrew Jackson is, you know, wielding too much power and, you know, it's got to be stopped. So he was always fighting against something. And so this letter, I think, you know, he was defeated in his last race for Congress. So he decided to, he told his constituents they could go to hell and he'd go to Texas. So, and that became his famous line.
Yeah.
And he was, Crockett was a very humorous kind of fellow. And he, you know, reminded me of an early Will Rogers, Mark Twain, or Groucho Marx. Because he was zany, you know, he's just a crazy guy and would pull pranks. So that's kind of what attracted me to the whole Crockett thing.
I'm really fascinated by you and your films and learning that you have this fascination with Davy Crockett. So can you just tell me more, like, around what year you got into him and you started collecting stuff?
Well, I first got into it in 1955 when Walt Disney had it was really the first miniseries, and it was called Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, or The Adventures of Davy Crockett. And I think it was in color. Of course, nobody had a color TV then, but my friends and I all were just completely enamored of this character because you know, a crack rifle shot, and he gave funny speeches, and he stood up for certain ideals that he believed in. And so I think that kind of piqued our interest. And we would, you know, we would play in the yard in our Davy Crockett suits with plastic fringe. I have a picture of myself.
I was going to ask, have muskets?
With my brother, yeah, we had little toy guns, and that was encouraged in those days. So, and we would go out and shoot imaginary enemies, and who knows. But it started my interest in history. Mm-hmm. And we used to have I used to own a ranch in Ojai, California, which is about an hour and a half north of L.A. Mm-hmm. And we'd have what we would call a rendezvous or a Davy Crockett rifle frolic, where we'd have, you know, anywhere from 20 to 50 to 70. It became a big deal over two weekend days in the fall, and everybody would dress in the period, and we'd do target shooting, and there would be a campfire, and Fess Parker attended one of them.
Really?
Yes.
You know, that just sounds like so much fun, and I love that this is one of your fascinations. And you mentioned before that Davy Crockett is one of history's funniest heroes, and so I wanted to know, have any of your film characters been inspired or influenced by Davy Crockett?
Well, I think perhaps down through the ages, because, you know, Davy Crockett was in a line of humorists. I mean, whatever else he was a humorist. And he comes from a line of American humorists, distinctly American humor, starting with Ben Franklin, and then Davy Crockett, and then Mark Twain, Will Rogers, Groucho Marx, Woody Allen, and then the Zucker brothers, I guess. So I'm very proud of, you know, that of inheriting that kind of brand of humor.
Yeah. What were some of the pranks he pulled what are some of your favorite pranks?
Well, one famous prank that he did was he was running for Congress against a guy named Adam Huntsman. And Huntsman had a wooden leg. And so there was a very close race in the town, and they would stay together in those days while they were campaigning. So he was found himself staying at the mayor's house, and the mayor was very influential, going to sway the votes. And so I think they were both kind of vying for his attention, and Crockett got frustrated with that because it wasn't in his nature to try to, you know, kowtow or suck up to anyone. So so the mayor had this beautiful daughter, and the mayor said, she's up on the second floor, and, you know, essentially don't mess with her. Mm-hmm. So they're sleeping in the middle of the night. Crockett gets up and he takes a chair and he goes up the stairs, pounding the chair on each step like a wooden leg. And opens the door. The daughter screams, and then he gets back into bed, and the mayor charges into the room. And of course, he knew it had to be Huntsman with the wooden leg. So, but Huntsman was the one who eventually defeated Crockett for the last time he ran for election. So, and he said, my constituents have chosen to elect a timber toe to Congress, so they can go to hell and I'll go to Texas.
Let's take a break right here. And when we get back, more from Zucker. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week via the menu at JinguHouseSATX.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. We're having a conversation with film director David Zucker. Zucker, his brother Jerry, and their childhood friend Jim Abrams formed the Zazz Trio. They wrote slapstick comedies together, including the 1980 hit film Airplane. The trio has a new book out called Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. It features a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the film and stories about the cast members. David Zucker also has a fascination with the king of the wild frontier, David Crockett. Crockett was a politician, soldier, and folk hero who inspired the 1950s Disney miniseries Davy Crockett, among other depictions. This piqued Zucker's interest as a kid, and he began collecting memorabilia. But to Zucker, Crockett is one of history's funniest people, and depictions of him don't do justice to his humorous nature. So let's return to my conversation with Zucker. So have you ever considered, or who do you think could play or capture the spirit of Crockett well? And have you considered writing something, some sort of portrayal of Crockett?
Well, I did. I wrote a script, and it was probably, I should have stuck to comedy, but what attracted me about Crockett's life was that, you know, he did have somewhat of a moral compass, and he's a character who, you know, was not only, you know, physically skilled, he was like the biggest athlete of his day, and also he was a stand-up comedian of his day. So I always thought that maybe Jim Carrey or Robin Williams would be a great Davy Crockett. But, I mean, Playing it seriously, but able to do those kind of crazy turns that was Crockett, which Walt Disney or John Wayne did not portray that. They just took the whole, you know, the basic John Wayne approach of, you know, straight hero, not a crazy guy.
So I think you've talked about it a little bit and just talking about how he was a funny guy and in these portrayals that he kind of gets depicted a little more seriously or a little more maybe flat. So what do you think people get wrong about Crockett?
You never know who somebody really was over, you know, a period of 200 years. So it's tough. But you get it from the actual historical facts and from the writings, and that's pretty much what we have. So you have to fill in the blanks. I know Quentin Tarantino, when he portrays serious historical characters, you know, just makes it up. I mean, he really, you know, that line when print the legend. And so we don't really know exactly who Crockett was, or really we have an idea what he looked like, because those characters who existed before photography, I mean, that's a real dividing line. And so we, you know, I think James Polk was the first president who was ever photographed, and Crockett, and also John Quincy Adams was photographed, and all Crockett knew all these people, but Crockett himself was never photographed. So it's left to the interpretation of historians or cinema people to figure out who these guys were. And for a while I was writing a script about Davy Crockett, but what happened is, you know, not every historical figure's life fits into a three-act structure for a movie, so it was difficult to do that. But for a while, I mean, if you look up my Wikipedia, it says, you know, my dream is to do a movie about Davy Crockett. Well, you know, it really isn't anymore, because, you know, so you can't do everything. But I do have some comedy scripts that I'm going to be shooting in the spring, actually.
So it seems like maybe it's not in your future. You're not thinking about it as much.
No.
Or not even like documentary style, or talking to, you said, you know, some historians, nothing like that.
I know many historians, and they all wonder, when am I going to do this movie? But it ain't going to happen. that's not what I'm going to do. I have a lot of interests, and I like interior decorating. I like construction. I like architecture. You know, I've remodeled or built like about 6 houses. And that's kind of been my hobby. And I love going to parties. I have a lot of stuff going on in my life. And but most of all, I do love writing with my writing partners, Pat Proft and Mike McManus. And so we've got these 2 scripts and we're going to produce them. So
that's awesome.
That's what we're working on.
So why do you think now is the time to donate this letter and to make it part of that collection?
I'm running out of wall space in my house. So I had to move this stuff. But I think that I was waiting for, the Alamo Foundation to get a real, live, accredited, world-class museum, which it now is. And so now is the time to do it. So, and I hope that, maybe by donating this letter and other items in my collection, it'll encourage others to do the same. I know Phil Collins has already. I haven't met him yet, but I hope to. I think we share a lot of this.
I think you do, yeah.
Yeah.
So how many things have you donated, or do you, what are your plans for the other items?
Gradually, I'm going to donate the other items. They need to be shipped. This letter I actually carried with me. I have a replica of the letter hanging in my house. And so the actual letter has been in a safe deposit box at my bank for 20 years. So, because I didn't want to be responsible for, really the safety of this letter. If my house burned down, I wouldn't care who was killed in the fire. But if the letter was, I was very concerned about the letter. Yeah.
Can you tell us how much did you buy it for? You said you bought it in Lubbock.
I bought it in Lubbock from a doctor, Dr. Robert Moore, who I became friends with after that. And he invited me to his house to make sure I wasn't just going to turn it over, just flip it and sell it for a profit. But once I convinced him that I was an actual Davy Crockett fan, he sold me the letter and we became friends. So the whole collection was... I don't think I want to say what I paid for it,
okay.
But it was, a lot less than it's worth now.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us more about how the letter is going to be brought in? You mentioned horses.
They have some kind of ceremony planned with somebody's going to ride in on a horse, and hopefully I won't be trampled too badly. And then I'm going to be asked to say a few words, and I will say a few words. And then they'll stop me at some point. Hopefully I can have another cup of coffee then.
Zucker also has a new book titled Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. This is a book that details the making of the hit 1980 movie Airplane. It is co-authored by David Zucker, his brother Jerry Zucker, and their friend Jim Abrams. They're also known as the Zazz Trio. Airplane became known for its parody and slapstick comedy humor. Here are some scenes from Airplane.
Would you like something to read?
Do you have anything light?
How about this leaflet, Famous Jewish Sports Legends?
Yes, thank you.
Roger.
Huh?
LA departure frequency, 123.9er.
Roger.
Huh?
Request vector, over.
What?
Flight 209er, clear for vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
We got a telegram from headquarters today.
Headquarters? What is it?
Well, it's a big building where generals meet. But that's not important right now.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Oh, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has 4 engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying. All together.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Airplane continues to be quoted today. Now let's get back to my interview with Zucker about his new book, which details the making of this movie. So, David, you also have a new book out called Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. What made you decide to co-write this book?
Well, we realized that even our close family members, like my wife, my my kids, and same thing with my brother Jerry and Jim Abrams. Their family didn't really know this story. And I mean, a few people knew the whole story, but we thought it was a very unique story of how we got into show business. Jerry points out in the book, no one looks at Eddie Murphy or Kevin Hart or, you know, any of these great comedians, and they never say, "Oh, I could do that." But somehow what we did, people think, well, we could probably do that. And, you know, and to some extent, they could be right, because it shows in the book how we, you know, we kind of had average skills. I mean, we were funny and we were talented, but it's the way we kind of went about it, and we had some good fortune along the way. You know, we started out in Milwaukee, and we just remodeled the back of a bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, where we all graduated from the University of Wisconsin. And we put on the show in a 70-seat theater, and that was successful at that level. So we loaded up a U-Haul truck, drove out to Los Angeles, and we started another theater, which was twice as large. And then we got on The Tonight Show. And from there, we kept doing the show, and we started writing movies. So, and it just showed how we do it, and all the mistakes we made. It wasn't all glory.
What do you think some of the biggest mistakes you made, or that were part of the making the movie?
Well, you know, the first draft of Airplane, well, we didn't even know how to write a movie. So we wanted to write a movie, and we had seen this movie Zero Hour, which was a 1957 black and white movie with the same plot, where there was food poisoning and a passenger has to fly down the plane exactly the way it is in Airplane. And so we saw John Landis, the director, on a television show and in an LA Times article. We befriended him. We asked him, "What does a script look like?" And he gave us one of his scripts. We used the form for that. We started writing the first draft. We had Beaver Cleaver flying down the plane. It was like, not the whole, not the eventual Airplane. We had to learn as we went. The first draft we wrote was not all that great, and we couldn't get it financed. So that I say in the book, I was so disappointed, but it turned out to be a, fortunate occurrence, because we weren't ready to do the movie. So we did Kentucky Fried Movie, and then we went back, rewrote Airplane, and then we had another piece of luck where every studio in Hollywood turned down the script to Airplane, but one guy whose name was Michael Eisner, who's the head of Paramount, thought, well, this could have possibilities, a comedy on an airplane. And so we landed at Paramount. So and they took us through a further rewrite of the script, which added a lot of great jokes. Just like, when we wrote the book, Surely You Can't Be Serious, the publisher, St. Martin's Press, our editor's name, Mark Resnick, and he said, well, you have to add 150,000 words. And so we said, okay, gave us a chance to do more jokes, I guess. So we did. We just added more interviews, and he turned out to be right. So I think the publisher did the same thing as Paramount. At Paramount, they really were good people, and they were smart, and they helped make the movie better.
Let's take a break right here, and when we get back, more with film director David Zucker. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. We're listening to my December interview with film director and writer David Zucker. He has a new book out titled Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. The title is inspired by this line in the 1980 Airplane movie.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Now let's return to my interview with Zucker, where he reacts to his film becoming a quotable hit. Well, did you anticipate that this would be the line that everyone would quote from your movie, or did you...
We didn't expect that, nor that the movie would still be, you know, played and quoted and loved, you know, 43 years later. So I think we were not surprised that the movie was a hit, because we had been trying to get backing for it for 5 years, and we kept telling people, this movie is going to be a hit. And so when it was, you know, we weren't surprised, but... You know, the fact that it's lasted this long and also across generations, you know, people tell me that they, you know, they watch it with their fathers or grandfathers, and you know, whole families watch it. I hear that a lot. So that's pretty satisfying.
So your book is also co-written, just like the Airplane movie and other movies were co-directed with your brother, Jerry Zucker,
right,
and Jim Abrams. So you three really have become, for a long time, an iconic trio. And how did you get to know Jim, and why do you think he fits so well with you and your brother?
Good question. You know, our families... were really close. Our fathers were business partners. There was it was Abrahams and Zucker Real Estate.
Oh, wow.
And they would, you know, deal in, you know, selling houses, building commercial office buildings. Our mothers were best friends. Our sisters were college roommates. I mean, and the Abrams would often come over to our house for dinner back in Milwaukee. And after dinner, invariably, Jim and Jerry and I would end up in our basement rec room playing ping pong. We bonded over the same sense of humor, although we were, you know, kind of years apart. I think Jim is 4 years older than I am and 6 years older than my brother Jerry. But we bonded. And so when in 1971, when I was able to borrow some videotape equipment from a friend of my dad's, and this is all in the book, I called Jerry and we said, we have to get together with Jim and make a theater.
So in your book, you also write about how Leslie Nielsen's pranks got the whole crew in trouble. I mean, what can you talk
he would,
more?
Yeah, Leslie was a kind of a closet clown, an anarchist, and all, he was just a big prankster. And so he would bring with him to the set this little diaphragm thing that he would hide, and it would make farting sounds. So, and he would do it on the set while somebody else was saying their lines and crack them up. And then pretty soon the whole crew bought these little machines from Leslie, and everybody was doing it. And so it disrupted the set, and the assistant director had to put his foot down and say, you know, these are banned from the set or you're fired. Of course, they couldn't fire Leslie, but yeah. But then every time when he would go on a talk show, I mean, you can see on YouTube when he goes on David Letterman, he's doing that fart machine. Yeah. And Letterman tried to take it away from him. Yeah.
So it was like that the whole time behind the scenes working with
him? That happened for a while. You know, again, you know, the legend is that he did it every day, but it was not for that long, but but the set was actually pretty businesslike. You know, just we had to make our days, and it was our first time directing, and you know, it was in our studio contract that they could fire us after 2 weeks. So the first day, our producer very wisely scheduled that those lines, Shirley, you can't be serious, and Leslie says, I am serious, and don't call me Shirley. And then everyone cracked up in dailies. And so pretty soon, our dailies, everybody would come across the lot to see our dailies, and they had to add a second screening room because it was so packed.
Wow.
Because, I mean, nobody had seen anything like it. Uh-huh. So Jeff Katzenberg, who was then, you know, a minor vice president there, called us that afternoon of the first day's dailies and said, don't worry, you guys are not going to be fired. They got it. But I think we were surprised that, wait, they didn't get it before they, the movie was greenlit, and it was it was $3 million, the budget, so they had to have some faith, but it was probably more likely that the studio thought it was Animal House on an airplane rather than really what it was.
There's another famous scene from Airplane that Zucker says he's not sure he'd be allowed to write today. This is the I Speak Jive scene. In this scene, two black passengers are trying to talk to a white stewardess, and there's miscommunication and misunderstanding. Then a white lady passenger, played by Barbara Billingsley, says that she knows how to communicate with the black passengers. Barbara was known for her role as June Cleaver in the 1950s show Leave It to Beaver. I talked to Zucker about this scene, and he told me that he doesn't regret writing it because he believes it pokes fun at everyone, and the dialogue was written by the two black actors who portrayed the passengers. Al White and Norman Gibbs wrote their own lines and those of Barbara's character. Let's listen to the scene.
Mm-hmm. Can I get you something?
It's your mofo butter laying me to the bone, jacking me up. Tight me.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Cuddy say can't hang.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Oh, good.
He said that he's in great pain and he wants to know if you can help him.
All right, would you tell him to just relax and I'll be back as soon as I can with some medicine.
Just hang loose, blood. She's gonna catch up on the rebound on the med side.
What it is, big mama. My mama raised no dummies. I duck her rap.
Cut me some slack, Jack.
Now that we've heard the scene, let's return to my interview with Zucker, where we continue our conversation. And so there's also another, I think, famous scene is the whole I Speak Jive scene.
Right. Yeah.
And so this is where a white stewardess is talking to a couple of black passengers, and she's, you know, not understanding what they're saying. And so then comes this kind of older white lady played by Barbara Billingsley, who played the mom in Leave It to Beaver.
We were obsessed with Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah. And so it's just so funny to see her in Leave It to Beaver and then see her in this role.
Right. Well, we used to kind of go for opposites. So, you know, we got the idea for the whole thing because Jerry and Jim and I went to Westwood, where all the movie theaters were in those days. And we saw a movie called Shaft with an actor named Richard Roundtree. And these were called blaxploitation movies. And we loved the movie. But as we were leaving the theater, we were saying, but we couldn't understand what they were saying. I think the joke evolved. Well, we were writing the Airplane script at the time. We said, how about we have two characters talking black jive and then we subtitle it. And then, you know, these gags, that was one day. And then the next day we said, so there's food poisoning. And how about somebody has to interpret it? And so who's the whitest lady on the planet? Well, it was June Cleaver. It was Beaver's mom. So that's how that all evolved.
So how did you approach her?
You call the agent. And she was not the first choice. Our first choice was Harriet Nelson.
Really?
You know, so because we grew up watching all these sitcoms on TV. And everyone was very white, and so this was where we wanted to get the person to translate. But I think what happened was that, and Harriet Nelson came in to meet, but I think unfortunately she read the script, and so I think she was a little bit shocked at what was going on in the script. Although, you know, even with today's standards, it's edgy, I guess. But you know, the captain over, played by Peter Graves, does, you know, go after that little boy. So
yeah.
I don't know if she quite knew. Well, look, Peter Graves didn't understand it when he read the script. He threw the script across the room.
He said it was garbage.
Yeah, but he said, this is the worst piece of garbage I've ever read. Our next choice was Beaver's mom. And she was happy to do it because, you know, these people are all actors. So, and mm-hmm. you know, coming out of Milwaukee, we had to think about that because, you know, when Robert Stack came out of this, I expected Elliot Ness, you know, with a machine gun and, you know, the three-piece vest, and he was an actor, you know, really an actor. So, you know, I think we kind of got a little more used to Hollywood in the process.
So who wrote I think you talk about this in your book, who wrote the Jive Talk itself?
Oh, so all we could do, you know, coming out of Milwaukee and, you know, our Beaver Cleaver existence, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. So these two guys, Norm Gibbs and Al White came in to audition for the part. And in the waiting room, they formulated some of this dialogue themselves. And they also looked it up on, actually probably Wikipedia didn't exist then, but they went and researched it. And so all their lines were written by them. It was like, in a few instances, we did not write people's lines. So we did not write Al and Norm's lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they also wrote Barbara's lines. And they taught her how to say it phonetically.
Really?
Yeah. And that's another story we tell in the book. And then Stephen Stucker, we could never write for him. He was the flamboyant air controller.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And he was in our stage show as the piano player. So we knew him, and we thought, we have to get Stephen Stucker in this movie. So we cast him, and then we called him up on the phone one day, and we said, okay, these are the questions you're going to be asked in the press conference. What kind of a plane is it? And then over the phone, he says verbatim, oh, it's a big, pretty white plane with wheels and red stripes. It looks like a big Tylenol. And that's exactly, we wrote it down. Yeah.
When we return to the show, we'll continue our conversation with the director of the 1980 movie Airplane and the Naked Gun series.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. We're listening to my December interview with film director and screenwriter David Zucker. He has a new book out called Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. Now let's get back to my interview. So kind of back to the jive scene. At that time, was there any reception to it, or do you think you could make that scene today?
Well, here, that scene, we show the movie, we show Airplane today, to audiences, and they laugh all the way through. There is no difference between, 43 years ago and today. However, were we to pitch any of those edgy gags from Airplane to studio executives, the gatekeepers today, they would probably never do it. They would say, well, you can't do that. That would offend people. But the thing is, if it's done the way it's done in Airplane, it doesn't offend anybody. I mean, white audiences loved it. Black audiences loved it, because what we did was, it was very even-handed. We put stupid white guy subtitles on it, like golly and gee. I mean, everybody could have fun in that movie. And the Peter Graves part, they're very sensitive today. I wrote an article for Commentary Magazine a few years ago, which was reprinted in the New York Post. And it was about, how comedy has been kind of damaged today by this oversensitivity. So, and I think it's been kind of corrupted by the 9.5% of people who don't have a sense of humor. And unfortunately, too many of those peoples are in studio executive boardrooms. So that's why my next movie is just going to be done independently.
Did people, when you were making this film, ever tell you, like, this is too much, this is...
Well, there's one thing we say in the book, that the studio at one point came to us, Katzenberg came to us. He said, we need you guys to make a list of 20 things, 20 jokes in the movie that couldn't happen. And so we thought, oh, no, there's a bunch of things, and half the movie can't happen. I mean, they say they're on instruments, and then we cut to the cockpit, and they're all playing, horns and violins and whatever. They're playing jazz, that was a rule that we have that we call that didn't happen. And we talk about the 15 rules that we have in our comedy. Doesn't necessarily apply to anyone else, but this is. You can get away with things if it's a split second. And of course, it completely takes you out of the movie, but only for a couple of seconds, and then it's off. And then we don't do anything to pursue that. So that was kind of a nerve-wracking thing. And for a while, we actually threatened to go to a different studio.
Really?
And so they finally, because they didn't want to let us direct, and we were insisting on directing, so they said, okay, you can direct, but you know, with two provisos that we can fire you after 2 weeks, and that we have to put our own guy, a past head of the studio, Howard Koch, on as executive producer. And we said, fine. We're fine with Koch or being fired. And Howard turned out, and we relate this in the book, to be such a great, great mentor and ally to us. And he taught us a lot. And everybody, we were so lucky to land at Paramount at that time. Paramount today, you know, a bunch of clowns.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. And I think, you know, even people who watch it today, like you said earlier, people who watch it today, they laugh the same. I think, yeah. People just laugh. They laugh and they take in the movie and they enjoy it.
Yeah, and the movie actually is in good taste. So, I mean, and I can say that because, you know, I'm proud of it, and there's nothing in that movie that I would change or that I would be even remotely ashamed of. And it's like there is nothing offensive about it. We do recount one story in the book where we had a joke. They said, Air Poland, please clear the runway. And we cut into the cockpit, and it's Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, and another blind musician. So, and we thought, and somebody called from the Jewish Anti-Defamation League and said they got wind of that joke, that gag, and they thought we should cut it. Mm-hmm. Because they said that young kids were Polish. It was like, and this was in the 70s, so there were Polish jokes. They had Polish jokes on Johnny Carson's show, and nobody thought anything of it. But he said that young Polish kids were growing up thinking they were thinking less of themselves because of this. And we actually said, you know, that makes sense. So we cut the gag. Mm-hmm. And 43 years later, I am so glad that we did. I mean, because that would have been embarrassment, because there's nothing in the movie that's hurtful to anyone. We make fun of everybody, but in a fun way, not in a Polish joke type of way. So look, you know, you learn. I'm glad we learned these lessons along the way, and so many things happened that were fortunate for us.
And we talked a little bit earlier about how Peter Graves called the script garbage and how he didn't initially want to be part of it. But how did you persuade him, and did his feelings change about the movie and the script?
Well, there are a couple of things that persuaded him. Our executive producer, Howard Koch, who was at the time, he was 10 years older than Graves. And he said, Peter, why don't you come in and meet the boys, as we were known at that time. And so he came and met with us, and I think he was surprised to see that we weren't the, you know, drugged out weirdos that he imagined after reading his his lines. But so we told him that we were just making fun of the image of airline pilots. And I mean, it's what I had to tell my mom, who she thought that was bad taste. Mm-hmm. So I said, no, this is not. If we're not making fun of pedophilia, it's like, it's the, how do you make fun of the image of these, you know, very straight airline pilots? That's the way you do it. Mm-hmm. How do you counter the, who could interpret Black Jive? Well, June Cleaver. So we would go for opposites. And I think he understood it. And then also his wife and his daughter were very helpful. They said, Dad, this is funny. You should do this. And he did. And Peter Graves and his wife and his daughter were sitting behind me when in the first screening of Airplane that we had at the Directors Guild. And they were laughing as loud as anyone in the audience. They just were cracked up. And I think Peter was so relieved and he says in the book, he was so surprised. He said, well, gee, I'm funny. You know, and I think the same thing with, I think they were all surprised. Stack turned down a percentage of the back end points in the movie because he didn't really know it would be a hit. And so Stack was completely surprised at the reaction and that the movie was a hit. And Leslie also, you know, I think he was surprised too, although he got it and he understood the humor. But I think he, in the book, he says he was still surprised.
Really?
Yeah.
So besides spoofing the, you know, those airplane disaster movies, you also went on to spoof these cop shows with the Naked Gun movies. And were you a fan of cop shows growing up, or what was your interest in making a cop parody?
Well, we loved movies. We loved serious movies. And so we actually loved those. You know, there was a string of disaster movies and airliner and trouble movies in the 70s. We loved those. Michael Eisner, who was the head of Paramount, also loved those movies. So he felt a connection to this idea. And then also growing up in the 60s, we were fans of, there was this television show starring Lee Marvin, black and white film noir TV series called M Squad. And that's what became Police Squad. It was exact copy of M Squad. You could probably look that up on YouTube. And then the scary movies, I was not a horror movie fan, but you know, the head of the studio called me up and said, we want you to do, you know, Scary Movie 3. And then because the Wayans brothers, who originated it, were onto another project, so he and I had done another movie for Weinstein, called an Ashton Kutcher movie, which was a flop. But he said, Zucker, you're a better director than your material. So he wanted me to do, and I was again fortunate to have Pat Proft with me and Craig Mazin, who were the writers of Scary 3, and that turned out to be a huge hit, as was 4.
At the time of the interview, Zucker said he was excited to be in San Antonio and anticipating his return.
Life is always an adventure, and I love coming to San Antonio because it's the Alamo. It's like really I have such a connection to this place, and I'm excited to be here now, and I'm excited to be here, you know, what is it, 4 years from now when the whole thing's done? And yeah, and I imagine they'll, because I will have written by that time another book and done 2 more movies, I'll be even more famous than I am now.
Yeah.
And they'll want me to, like, you know, be the Grand Marshal of whatever parade they have. I all I need is to, basically, what I've always needed is more attention.
Yeah, well, yeah. We're going to get you that with
okay,
this interview.
Thank you.
So.
Thank you, yes.
Well, David, thank you so much for being on our show today. It was so fun to talk to you. It was such a pleasure.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. David Zucker is a director, producer, and screenwriter. His movies include the 1980 Airplane, the Naked Gun series, and the 2000 Scary Movies. This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla, and thank you so much for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.